In the beginning was the Word, and that Word was a vibration, a mighty sound which vibrated and reverberated in an ever-widening circle. All creation is within that circle. Think of your life as being held in a circle of light in which you are enfolded, that you are living within that Word, within that circle of light, and power and protection. W.E. Suppose that some local authority suddenly decided to drive a roadway through the middle of Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral, and at the same time to erect cottages clustering round the cathedral precincts. What an outcry would ensue when traffic began to rumble through the sacred building. Yet this has already happened, and is still happening, to a cathedral perhaps more significant than either Westminster or St. Paul's. It is happening at Avebury, a temple so vast that it would house a dozen or so Stonehenges and nearly as many Westminster Abbeys. If you will study our picture giving a reconstruction of how Avebury might have looked long ago, you will glimpse something of its expanse, its dignity, even majesty. Then compare what you see with a present-day aerial photograph, and observe how the place has shrunken, how its massive monoliths have been uprooted to build the cottages which clutter up its expanse and spoil the line of the stone's dignified array. It will be seen how Avebury village also overruns the enclosure itself, while an occasional huge monolith stands in some cottage garden, an incongruous sight. Worst of all, roads have been built right round and across the enclosure, so that now huge lorries thunder past where once the pilgrims walked and worshipped. Yet this is still a noble place, the national monument of all our monuments. In a sense, its sanctity, dignity and greatness remain unimpaired, while in comparison, we humans seem such trivial creatures. Like insects we cluster and defile, and like insects in a moment are gone, while Stonehenge, Avebury, they remain. The day we chose for Avebury was one of summer's best. We had driven over early to avoid the crowds, so had the place practically to ourselves. A small herd of cows browsing among the stones gave us a placid welcome, and we settled down beside them, nearly out of earshot of the traffic, and alone except for our animal brethren. It was in conditions such as these, in peace and sunlight, that the following message came through. Avebury Today. Avebury, July 1966. Avebury Circle is a prehistoric monument as much surpassing Stonehenge, says Aubrey, as a cathedral doth a parish church. According to archaeology, the remains at Avebury consist mainly of a massive circular earthwork, 3/4 mile round and about 15 feet high, with a fosse, originally 30 feet deep, on its inner side, thus suggesting a religious rather than a defensive object for the entrenchment. Fringing the inner edge of the fosse once stood a gigantic circle of unhewn megaliths, and in the center of the enclosed area were two smaller concentric circles. The largest stones weigh about 60 tons. From the circle an avenue of stones, many recently re-erected, led southeast, beyond West Kennet, to a group of small stone and timber circles called the Sanctuary, long since vanished, and now marked out on the ground. The message reads: the ritual here at Avebury was linked with the moon. I see a great crowd gathered to perform an elaborate ritual of obeisance to the moon, or to what I can only describe as a goddess of the moon. At that time the moon looked much bigger than it does now, and there was life on it. The people on the moon were advanced in spiritual knowledge, and a form of communication with them existed. It could be taken that this life on the moon, like that on Earth, as the vision goes on to reveal, was not yet in dense physical form. This great goddess sits enthroned as ruler of this place. The ritual here was performed under her direction, its object being the actual production of life in form, the bringing into physical manifestation of life itself, coming from the etheric world. You see, in those supremely distant times, life in wholly physical form had hardly come into being. The ancient mother ritual, which eventually brought about the creation of life in physical form, came from Mu, the motherland. This temple of Avebury was the heart and center of all these ceremonies. The ritual was designed to invoke the occult, the invisible power of the gods, and then it was concentrated upon the movement of the cells and the building up of form. These great stones of the temple came into physical manifestation from the etheric forms, created by ritual by these people. I feel that all these stone temples in Britain were built by materialization from etheric form. Now I am aware of movement, of music, harmony, sound, the music and the rhythm of the earth and the whole solar system. All are attuned, in unison. This tells me that this ancient ritual was linked with powers inherent in the solar system itself, and that the people knew how to contact outer space. All this was millions of years ago, at least, it seems to me like millions. I can see the races come and go, come and go, come and go, while ages pass. I see a great civilization work up to a climax and then decline. Afterwards, a period follows when the land is overrun with people like savages, then yet another civilization grows up and then another follows on. At one time the people living here were like the American Indian. They had red skins and appeared very tall and had noble bearing. Men today look like midgets by comparison. The grander the spirit became, the bigger grew the body. After death these people were buried in the center of a Vibri temple, lying in a circle, with their feet to the middle, like big clock, face might look. Originally this place was one of the great creative center of this planet. The Great One who once ruled here seems to me to have an immense headdress, suggestive of a crown, but its several points are like magnets attractant force and power down to them. I see sparks glittering at the points of the crown. Now I see that the goddess is in a procession up the avenue of stones towards Silbury Hill, and I see her enthroned on Silbury. This was an immense procession. Some of the people went before her and the rest followed. All the etheric life, such as gnomes and fairies, joined in the procession as well. Now I see ritual movement about an altar in the center of vast congregation. Perhaps the great ceremony is over. These standing stones at Avebury now look to me like shrunken remnants of what was once a far vaster temple. It was built in three sections. First came the inner temple, then a space and then another wall or circle of stones, again a space and then another wall and then the open sanctuary. Pillars, vast beyond belief, supported the temple. I am losing my vision. I am coming back. Life looks so feeble now. The village now looks like a lot of toy things set down in a haphazard way. A reconstruction of the Temple of Avebury, Ministry of Works. The foregoing message would seem to take us back into almost inconceivably remote time when it refers to the creation of physical form from etheric substance, and communication with a form of life existing on the moon at the time, which we must conceive as existing, like Earth life itself, at an etheric rather than a physical level. Through ages since, the moon's influence has been subtly connected with the woman and the creation of life. Remnants and indications of mother worship exist throughout the world, and many students of ancient monuments in Britain state that mother worship was at one time generally accepted. In the English Downland, H. J. Massingham suggests, may not Avebury have been the temple tomb of the supreme goddess of heaven and earth, and the abodes beneath the earth, who died with the winter and was reborn with the awakening of nature? Rightly did the ancient wisdom incorporate the mother as its symbol of worship, and also wisely because the same forms of worship will surely return, bringing in their train both peace and plenty. It is right that womanhood as a whole should be housekeeper entrusted with the earth's bounty, and the womb of the mother as the receptacle of life itself, created by love, has played at least as important a part in the affairs of mankind as has the male's over-eager intellect. True, the male has dominated the female for many centuries, but it has not always been so, and in time to come the order will again change and woman will take her rightful place as the visionary partner. As with the vision at Wayland Smithy, while this book was being compiled, shorthand notes of a much earlier vision received in October 1949 by chance, came to light. There are differences between the two messages and they may well touch different strata of human experience. But there are also striking points of similarity and they tend to confirm one another, particularly since the first had lain utterly forgotten for so long. Both appear to reach far back to that Adenic period already referred to before man had been wholly bound down in matter. Overbury from the air. Overbury, October 1949. I can see figures in flowing robes of what appears to be white ether. They come in right up the avenue of stones to this circle in which we are sitting, and circle round and round until they reach the very center where they create a central point, like an altar, and on this altar I see a warm rosy fire. The concentration of the ceremony is on this fire. At a certain point comes an outpouring of rosy light, the warmth of the fire. Then there seems to be the manifestation of a great being. A great fountain of light rises and spreads all over the surrounding country. They are very big people with beautiful bodies and beautiful physique. Oh, this is a temple of magic. There are fairies and elemental beings here, uniting with the human beings. The human beings seem to be almost worshipped by these elementals as gods, and they were gods in those days, who had control over the elements. And they were gods because of the light which had been released in them, which they had brought with them to the earth from the invisible ethereal planets. Yes, they were god-men here. I think that these things happened before the earth was yet solid. It was in a more etheric and fluid state. I can hear the beat, beat, beat of these people walking solemnly, and then at a given moment the sun broke through, not the physical but the spiritual sun, broke through into the mind. Into the consciousness of the people. The great white light. The light. The light shines. The light. The light. I can see people here, sitting round as in a vast amphitheatre, watching this ceremony in the centre, and the priests and priestesses passing round and round building up this core, this centre of creative fire. There seems to be a nucleus right in the centre of this circle which holds everything in its course. It attracts everything to it and holds it, and I see these beings working up this power as they revolve round this central point, this core. Men were taught to concentrate on this one central point, this nucleus to which the electrons were drawn by centrifugal force. The neophytes were taught the secret of molding and moving matter by a tremendous effort of divine will, by fixing their minds securely on that one nucleus, that one central point. They could move stones, they could produce any form they wanted out of practically nothing. It was done by concentration on this central point by divine will. But there was always perfect form, always perfection. Whatever they wanted to create, they had to hold that vision in their spirit, in their mind, and it gradually materialized or was brought down from the mental level to the astral and then the physical level. These people were God-men, they were not just of Earth. They were masters from other planets. Similar/link, they came on rays from other planets, and these rays all seemed to converge upon central points here, in this island, in Britain. These stones, as at Stonehenge, mark the place where these cosmic or planetary rays meet. People will learn that there are these points all over the British Isles, where there was a concentration of planetary rays. And at such points there is a tremendous spiritual impetus and inspiration. These points are like the chakras of the light of this mystic isle. This is an entrance here into the inner world, into the higher, the real world. Now I am getting the feeling of a mighty impact here and of the earth being pushed off its axis. Terrific confusion. But this was not by accident, it was all in the plan to make another beginning on earth. To bring in a fresh stream of souls. There is an old world and a new world, and this new world is born in the death of the old, or, in a sense, in the crucifixion of the old. You must remember that whatever takes place in the outer or material world, also takes place in the inner world, for there is always cause and effect. The cause lies in the inner world and the invisible, and the effect is seen in the outer and the visible. Every cycle of life takes this course from the inner to the outer and from the outer back again to the inner, an in-breathing and an out-breathing. Although it might seem that this was a catastrophe, it was only a mighty manifestation, an involution and devolution, a fresh out-breathing of souls was born to set out on the new evolutionary spiral. They have gone round and round the cycles of life, just as the people process round this temple. One day our present cycle will arrive at the peak, or that central point again, the heart of the rose heart, the rose stone, as at Stonehenge, the stone where they make or made the great sacrifice, the great surrender, and then a burst of light, release from bondage, release from physical matter and rebirth into this eternal light. This happens to individual souls, but it also happens to the race, it happens to universes. All is movement, pulsation, movement, just like cell life ever's growing and increasing, and every cell which increases is almost like a life period which keeps being added to. This is a picture of eternity. Oh! It seems so strange to come back and open my eyes to the little people of Earth, when I have been wandering in infinity. Stonehenge 7. When the angel of the sun came over Stonehenge. Ancient wisdom teaches that behind and within the physical sun is the spiritual sun or white light. The ancients were taught how to use and direct this white light for the blessing of their life on earth. They were taught how to work with the angels to control the elements. They had the secret of how to work within natural law to maintain the fertility of the soil. Some of the ancient temples in your country were centers from which the whole countryside was enriched by the radiation of the great white light. W.E.I. What follows is the result of a number of visits to Stonehenge. These experiences were later combined and published in a magazine in the form of imaginary letters which record the gist of what was seen and heard. The letters are supposedly written on a midsummer day some thousands of years ago. Beloved, during the night which has passed and during the dawn when it seemed that God Himself came down to dwell among men, my thoughts have often flown to you. Again and again I felt you at my side while we paced continuously through the night around the Temple of Stonehenge. At times we even seemed to be alone together, in spite of the crowds of men and women reaching out to the edge of the plain which surrounds the temple. Those people had come far, some from countries across the seas. I spoke with men from across the water, where they have built long avenues of stones to mark the paths of the sun. Thousands of men and women tread these paths, on occasion, chanting, singing, invoking God, so that the very soil and the gentle ethers above and within become impregnated with worship and prayer. Thereafter these are holy places, the paths of the sun. The pilgrims here have come from many lands, crossing the narrow seas in ships that ply to and fro. Some of the holy ones, the priests of the sun, come more secretly, none knowing how. It is said that with their mastery over the power of sound, by intonation and invocation, their bodies become lighter than air. Another ancient man told me that he once saw one of the vast cross pieces of the Trilithons at Stonehenge being replaced after an earth tremor had dislodged it. This is secret, so say nothing. He saw the priests gather round that stone as it lay on the ground. They joined hands and marched round it chanting, then stood with arms upraised, invoking, commanding. The stone then rose apparently of its own volition, steadily as under precise direction. By now it was night and stone shone as if lit from within, as if permeated with light. It rose, guided by those upraised commanding hands and wills until it settled back on its monster upright stones as gently as a bird. Safe back, its light shone for many hours until it gradually became again cold stone. I was told that the whole mighty structure of Stonehenge was raised in this way. The labor of man was used to shape the stones. This done, each upright and cross piece weighing many tons was rendered weightless by the infusion of light and sound. Each mighty stone was then brought across the trackless land from the quarry to the site of the temple. Even those smaller blue stones in the outer circle were transported in this way from the fairy-ruled mountains of Wales. The man who told me, said that unbelieving people in the future would wonder at the ruins of Stonehenge, and bring out marvelous theories as to how it all happened. But the truth will be far too simple for them to understand, for they will have lost the magical powers, which are now common to the priests of the Sunday before sunset came. I stood on a great barrow under which kings lie buried, and viewed the scene. Already men and women had taken their places around the outer circle of stones. The inner was kept clear by order of the priests. The multitude reached out from that outermost ring, standing so thickly that only heads and faces could be seen. All were very still. Their very breathing was audible, so silent was the night. All were barefooted. None spoke. Silence seemed to well up from the earth herself, as if she too were aware of the blessing which was to come, as were all creatures from the lowest to the highest. Even the very birds had ceased to sing, except that in the distance a nightingale caroled to the departing sun. For the rest, silence lay over the multitude, a multitude which was at one in prayer for the blessing of the sun on all creatures and on Mother Earth herself. As we waited, I believe I heard the earth breathe and sigh as if she felt the pangs of birth. And I bent down to touch the earth and bless her. Was she not mother of men? The scent of the trodden earth rose sweetly. Each bruised blade of sacrificial grass gave forth its incense, and many a trodden herb in that grass breathed a richer, sharper scent. Stonehenge today. It seemed that the earth herself, the body of the earth, held sweetness. Yes, sweeter than rich newly turned soil was that savor of Mother Earth. Hesitating on the fringe of the crowd, and creeping among their feet, came little furry creatures of the plain and countryside, normally wild and fearful, but tonight unafraid, their coats glossy from the lush herbage of June fields, bright-eyed, and tonight at one with man. Night has fallen now. Try to see with my eyes and hear with me, for I long to share with you the marvels I have witnessed. I have never seen the stars more luminous or the great plain so populous with little creatures. For now the little wild creatures of the countryside gathered ever more thickly than before, the birds still on the wing, although they should have nested long before, timid animals man rarely sees, all came like pilgrims to a shrine, stealing among the standing men and women, intent on reaching the enclosed space within the outer circle of stones. Once there, without enmity, without a sign of fear of each other or even of man, they waited. As I watched, some big beast brushed against me in passing. Startled, I turned round and looked into the face of a great bear which had come wandering from the depths of faraway forests, drawn hither unconsciously by the power. Unafraid, we passed each other by. Then came the sound of horns, and the white-robed priests came among us, marshalling us into ranks. Let me explain that Stonehenge is built with an inner group of pairs of great upright stones, topped with stone cross pieces. Standing beside the upright stones are smaller blue stones from Wales. This inner shrine is not a true circle, but open at one end towards the sunrise. At the closed end is the rose-colored altar stone. Around the ring is, first, a complete circle of blue stones and then another of upright stones with stone cross pieces, enclosing the temple. Beyond this another outermost circle, this time of wooden uprights. A visitor to Stonehenge today will find most of the central horseshoe standing, with its attendant blue stones. The rose-colored altar stone has several others fallen upon it. About a third of the outer circle of stones is still standing, but of the outermost wooden circle no trace remains. Vestiges of the ancient trackway of the sun can be seen, now called the processional way. This is not to be confused with the great ridgeway referred to earlier. The stone on which the director of ceremonial once stood is intact and is called the Hellstone. Try to picture yourself standing behind the altar stone, looking directly to where the sun will presently rise. On either side of you and behind you loom up the great trilithons, 20 or more feet high, with their attendant blue stones close beside them. Nothing obscures your view. You can look directly through the outer circles, then out through the wooden uprights of the outermost circle, and what do you see? You see a straight grass track marked on either side by a trench and upright stones, reaching out seemingly to the horizon. Actually the distance is nothing like so great. This track marked by its rows of stones and its trenches is of primary importance, for this is called the trackway of the sun, and down it comes the light of the risen sun to bless the earth and all men dwelling thereon. In the middle of the trackway, a little beyond the stone circles, is a stone on which stands a high priest to direct the ceremonies. Now to try to tell you how it all happened. I have told how the priests came among us with their horns to marshal us. The horns set my blood tingling to their thrilling note, but all the people were very orderly and quiet, for many had been before to the ceremony at midsummer dawn, and were already awed and prayerful. The crowd was divided. Half of us were led along one side of the trackway of the sun out to its end, where the ground dipped. The other half, men, women and even children, were led out along the opposite side of the trackway. None trod the trackway itself on the outer journey. Immediately opposite us, over the horizon, we knew the sun would presently rise. Already we could feel its magnetic power drawing us, filling us as we all stood facing the sun. All was profoundly silent. Then the horn spoke again, not in command, but invoking the sun, praying for its beneficence. We knew what we must do then. We must absorb, fill ourselves, literally breathe in that sun. For human breath is magical. The priests heal with breath expelled a sound they can raise great weights, as I have already described, or raise a building to the ground. We ordinary men and women on this night of nights were shown how to practice this magic. Of what we were told, I can say little, but we breathed in the sun's power and might. We filled ourselves with the sun's breath, for the sun also breathes, and having done so, we turned and paced slowly back in procession towards the temple, down the trackway of the sun, breathing out the sun's light upon the trackway. Yes, pure light. Our breath was now instinct with the power of light from the sun, and it was breathed out in a song of power, for as we marched we sang. Our chant was controlled and led by the horns and by the choir of the priests, so that it followed one dominant pattern of song throughout, repeating and repeating itself, commencing deep down then rising, rising, rising to a great cry of triumphant joy, and by this cry we gave out, gave back all that we had received from the sun. And this not once, but continuing through the night. Having marched down the trackway, when we reached the temple, one half of us swung right to encircle the stone outer circle, the other half swung left to perambulate the circle of wood. Thus in two orderly circles, each turning against the other, we paced around Stonehenge, afterwards returning to the end of the trackway to reenact the ritual, over and over again as the hours passed. Personally, I knew no weariness. Even now I feel fresh and joyful. But I soon learned the reason why the trackway of the sun was so called, for as we paced down it, I saw the trackway itself and the air above it were becoming luminous with an aura of light. I looked down and saw that my feet were walking through pools of light, and indeed that all were wading through a luminous ether which clung, so that we ourselves became dimly luminous, and more, that in some way we were conveying that light down the length of the trackway to the temple, which in its turn was becoming luminous. Not until then did I realize that we ourselves had become so raised in spirit that we could see things previously invisible to our mortal eyes, and that the purpose of this night of marching and chanting was to set our spirit free, so that we might see in this fashion. For now I saw Stonehenge revealed in its glory, the stones themselves illumined as from within. I saw the light pulsing through every stone. Each of the grey weathered uprights emitted a dull golden light, the blue stones a blue radiance which shone afar. The altar stone shone a deep rose. As the blood flows through the veins of a man's body, so the currents of light flowed through these stones. This was so wonderful, that for a time I ceased to sing and could only watch. Then more wonders unfolded, for at last I saw the reason why these blue stones had been brought from those far away Faeridan mountains. For the stones had power to induce, to draw hither the fairies. I saw them come, I saw the little people declare themselves, made visible to man. They walked, they played, they danced among the assembled animals lighter than any thistledown, graceful as embodied air itself. These were the flower fairies, and they brought with them the scent of flowers. They were colored as the flowers, scented also, but more bright, more sweetly. There came more of the little people, some rising out of the earth itself, and others were dwarf men and gnomes, which I noticed kept close to the stones and could walk through them as you or I walk through water. Stone was their habitat, I knew,